Welcome to a special edition of the Monday Morning Quarterback podcast. I'm Richard Deitch, along with producer Andy DeGore, and my special guest on the phone, or you shouldn't say my special guest, but our colleague, Robert Klemko. This is going to be an interesting podcast because it's not, we decided we wanted to do one, and it's not based on any preseason games or season preview, but this is unique to Robert Klemko, who spent 4 days in Ferguson, Missouri, where he did reporting both on high school football there as well as the protests and riots that have happened in the wake of the Michael Brown shooting. We'll get into with Robert why he went down there, what he saw, but this was a story that was obviously very, very close and important to him, and he will tell us how he made the decision, obviously, along with Peter King and some of the editors here, to go down there and report on the story. Maybe not something you'd expect a sports writer to do, but sports writers cover things that go beyond sports, and you should want, in my opinion, sports writers to do that. So let's bring in Robert Klemko, who's on the phone with us right now. And Robert, let me start off with really the sort of the basic question for you, and that is, why did you feel compelled to go to Ferguson and to cover this story?
Sure. Well, I thank you for taking the time with me, and I want to thank Andy DeGore, who I think is an excellent producer that I always love working with. But I think that the impetus for the story was I went to a preseason game, and obviously, like pretty much everybody in the country, I'd been following the situation in Ferguson. And I talked to David Bast, who was a defensive end for the Bears, and he grew up about 5 miles from where Michael Brown was shot and killed. And we spoke a little bit about what was it like to grow up as a black teenager there, and what's it like to go back now? Now, you know, he has a certain amount of wealth. And he discussed the racial profiling that happens there, and how it's still a problem, an even bigger problem, when he goes back and you know, he drives his nice car around the neighborhood. He's almost certain every time he goes home he's going to be pulled over and searched. So we talked about that, that the mistrust between the community and a lot of the African-American population there. And me and Peter King and I talked about it, and we just said, you know, we wonder what it's like for these high school football players, because this is the beginning of the season for high school football all over the country, and these guys are dealing with that in addition to this, what's become a national crisis. What are they thinking as they're going through this?
Robert, what did you do when you first arrived? I think it's interesting to people, like when you head to a town that's in the middle of something rather momentous. What do you do as a reporter? Where's the first place you go? How do you situate yourself? How do you get your bearings on the story?
Yeah. Well, this was a completely unique and first-time experience for me. I'd never seen anything like an entire street shut down, police barricaded, and people gathering in droves and protesting in the middle of the street, screaming, "No justice, no peace." An absolutely surreal scene. It looked like the beginning of an apocalypse movie, the way that all of the storefronts were boarded up and spray painted over with things like, you know, black owner, don't loot. So I went into a tent to hide from the rain, and it ended up being an Al Jazeera tent. The same guys who had their equipment disassembled by police on one of the first days of the protest. And they now had a security guy with them who was a resource officer at one of the schools. And I asked him if he had any numbers over at McClure High School, and he gave me a number. And I called that number, and then you just keep calling numbers until you get to the person you want to get to. And I eventually reached the high school football coach, who was more than happy to talk with me about the lives of his players and how he's trying to keep them out of harm's way.
Robert, let's talk about that high school and the players that you spoke with. These are young guys, 17, 18, 16, 15 years old, who are living through something that is pretty extraordinary in their town. And they obviously have, you know, some of these guys may have known Michael Brown. But one, regardless of that, the thing that was interesting to me in your piece was that most of them had some kind of dealings with police there. And in general, those dealings were not great. So when you spoke to the players on that team, and you don't have to categorize all of them or generalize all of them, but give us a sense of some of the some of the kids you talked to, and how do they feel about what's happening in their streets?
Right. Well, a lot of them had negative interactions, as you mentioned. And, you know, they were all different, but they all had sort of the same premise that police overstepped their bounds. There's not a lot to do for kids in that neighborhood. It, you know, it's a suburb of St. Louis. They're not exactly city kids, but they're not country kids either. So there's one area called The Loop. It's a shopping district where teens congregate and hang out, and almost all of them had a story of being harassed or booted from The Loop for doing nothing more than standing around. And they felt that their white peers did not get the same treatment. A lot of them had been either pulled over or searched on the street based on their appearance being similar to that of a person who had committed a robbery. And that felt like, to them, kind of the catch-all police explanation for a search that to them feels illegal. So that was the experience for most of them. Now, there was one player who actually has a relative, or his stepfather, is a police officer, and he is he's a boy who in sixth grade was thrown up against a car and searched on suspicion that he committed a robbery when he was 12 years old. And his story is fascinating to me because he ended up growing up to want to be a state trooper after having conversations with his stepfather about the incident.
Robert, what did the players, when you spoke to, how do they relate how does football play in all this? Is football any kind of a refuge away from it? How do they, can they focus on practice? It's, again, you know, you're trying to prepare for a season, but there's this just kind of incredible thing going on in your community as you're getting ready to play a high school football season.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of them do see it as a refuge. But the coach, who you might imagine would want to keep their minds off of this, is embracing the opportunity to teach them something about this whole situation. I mean, perfect example, the coach is supposed to have a practice one day. They have to get in a certain amount of practices to be able to play the first game of the season. But he asked the group, you know, just to know, how many of you know who the Black Panthers were? And very few people raise their hands. He gets a lot of blank stares. So he spends that practice and shows them a civil rights documentary, Eyes on the Prize, that discusses, you know, all manner of movements during that time. So I think that they love being out on the field, but this is something that's constantly in the back of their minds, just because they're seeing the protests as they go around town every single day. So a lot of the adults in their lives, while they want them to concentrate on football and they want them to stay off the streets at night so that they can play in that Friday night game, they're still talking with them and using this as a teaching moment in this community, which was really refreshing to see.
Robert, these kids basically found out about the shooting via their Instagram account. That's what you wrote. That's kind of, if nothing else, it sort of tells you something about where we are in 2014, that they learned of a shooting via Instagram.
It's extremely unique. I mean, you think about, I think about Columbine and how everybody found out via cell phone, and that was kind of the first youth cell phone national tragedy. And then I remember I grew up in D.C. where the sniper came to the Maryland suburb, and we all found out about it through text. We'd heard that somebody was shot, you know, six blocks down the street, a mile down the street. And the texts were flying, and now this is really the first social media crisis, national crisis experienced by children. So they're all seeing Michael Brown's dead body out there just over and over again on their Instagram feed, and then they walk over there and take pictures, or take their own pictures. And that's how they learn about this, and that's how they live through it and gather information. And they're watching so closely what people like you and me are tweeting about their town.
Robert, you were in Ferguson for 4 days, and you were there for maybe there for three nights or four nights. But reading your Twitter feed on some of those nights, the scene that you were a part of felt very dangerous. You know, there's sort of a lot of menace in the air. And if I'm correct about this, at one point you were arrested. I don't know how formally or what, or if I'm describing that right, but why don't you tell us exactly what happened, and was it a formal arrest? Or because when I speak for myself, when I was reading your timeline, that was pretty surreal. One, the fact that that happened, and two, that you're also able to sort of tweet, for lack of a better word, a live arrest. So what can you tell us in terms of sort of providing larger context?
Sure. Well, when I went down there to write this story, I knew that I wanted to see and felt that I needed to document the protest. And even though they didn't directly relate to the high school story, just as a journalist, you know, you want to be there. And I offered up my services to Time Magazine, and I contributed to some of their reporting. But I did a lot of tweeting. And I went down on the first night and saw the protest, got a feel for what was going on, realized that there was gunfire going coming from the protester side at other protesters, at police, decided I'd keep a little bit better distance on the second night. And then I was up at the police command center, and I heard a crowd advancing, and I knew they must have passed the barricade on the south end of the street, and they were coming towards the command center. So I ran over there, took an Instagram video of them chanting, you know, Michael Brown, things like no justice, no peace, hands up, don't shoot. And then police tore around the corner in armored vehicles and started a tear gas assault on the oncoming crowd. So I ran up to the top of this hill and recorded another Instagram video from there. Then I retreated once the tear gas cloud had kind of hit me. And, you know, it's a completely debilitating thing. And so I couldn't see. And these police tell me I got to turn back. I can't go behind this building. So I got to go back into the gas. Another police officer grabs me and sits me down and hands me a bottle of water and asks me if I'm okay and sends me in the right direction. So about 25 minutes later, that whole area was cleared. I went to go and walk back down to Florissant, the main drag, to see what was happening with protesters, because we're hearing on police radios just incredible mayhem happening down the street. And I run into this perimeter that they've created around their command center, me and two other journalists. And we try to pass them, and they point the assault rifle at us, and we say we're media. They put the rifle down, and we begin talking with actually Captain Ron Johnson, who's been running the show there, about how we want to go past. And he says no. And we say why, and he says they attacked the command center. And we said, well, no, they didn't. There was no actual attack. And then Captain Johnson said, you need to leave. Like, if you're here when the squad car gets here, you're getting arrested. So we began to walk away, and they began to follow us. And when the squad car arrived, we were arrested. He said, you're under arrest. They put the zip ties on us, and we pleaded our case. We said, we followed all of your instructions. And then Captain thought about it for, God, it had to be a couple minutes, and then just said, cut these guys loose. So officially, it ended up being a detainment. Now, the most bizarre thing about it was how, like, lackadaisical it was. You know, he said, you're under arrest, cuff these guys. And then the cops standing there behind me fiddling with his handcuffs. And so I just figured I'd fire off a tweet, Captain Johnson is arresting us. And not knowing that it would be something that would blow up like it did. My one regret is that it took away from the experience that the protesters were having just maybe a quarter mile away. I hate for anybody to think that the media tried to make itself a story out here, and it's an easy thing to assume when you see journalists interviewing other journalists on CNN and you know, media people tweeting about their experiences as opposed to other people's experience. But I think it is telling about, you know, how exactly police are handling a situation when they're being as aggressive as they are with media and keeping them sort of out of bounds.
Robert, I think the question that is a fair one, and a lot of people have asked this on Twitter, and they've asked it of you, obviously, and every other journalist that's there, is how do you see the line between recording what's going on and almost being an activist when it comes to journalism, and then maybe even taking activism so far to the point where some journalists are making, or at least being accused of making themselves the story? How do you know, you've probably been at least on social media accused of, at least in some quarters, of contributing to the chaos. So how in your own mind have you weighed the idea of you're an independent observer reporting these things for the public versus you have your own beliefs about what's going on and you're involved and you're in the middle of it?
Yeah. Well, I think if you're a journalist out here and you don't have strong opinions about what's going on, then you're just uninformed. And some people are like that. Some of the camera guys I talked to, the photographers, they're down there for the rush. Me, I went down there because I felt strongly about several different aspects of it. But I just kept telling myself as I was tweeting, just record. Just record what's happening. Tell the story of what's happening without injecting your personal influence into it. And I think a lot of people kind of, you know, saw me coming from a sports background and said, hey, maybe this is an unbiased look at things. So I did not really get a lot of Twitter feedback saying, oh, you're on one side or the other. I think the more you're in a situation like that, like if I had been there 6-7 days and had just like all of those experiences that some of those reporters have, it would have been increasingly hard to not seem as though I was falling on one side. And I think that's the challenge if you have a career in that business. But for me, it did not feel difficult because I really felt a responsibility to record.
Robert, how, and maybe this is really an impossible question to answer like in a short podcast, but how would you say your race and your age have impacted how you viewed this story or through the prism that you viewed this story?
Yeah. Well, I think that, I mean, probably nobody knows this, but I'm a half African-American and half Ukrainian-American. My father is a Ukrainian immigrant, and I spent some time in Ukraine from the suburbs of Maryland. I went to one of the most diverse high schools in Montgomery County. So I don't really identify, so to speak, with one race or the other. And I think I come at it the story from that sense in a pretty neutral way. I certainly have opinions about how police should handle something, how protesters should handle a situation like this. But to your question, what was your question?
My question, listen, you know, I think I knew that. I think I knew that you were, I don't know if you consider yourself mixed race, that'll be my phrase. I didn't know you were from the Ukraine, which is nice. It means you probably can play soccer a little bit, Robert.
Not at all.
But I think, you know, when you are covering a story that has, at least in Ferguson, you were there for multiple nights. Most of the people I assume you saw on the street were between 20 and 35. Most of them, I imagine, were Black, African American, and so if you are affiliated with that ethnicity at all, I think it has to. I shouldn't presume anything. It might shape how you view everything. It might not. So that's where my question went to you, is that does it, not even just race, Robert, but you're a young, you know, you're in your 20s, and you saw a lot of people in their 20s on those streets on those nights.
Yeah. I think I identified with a lot of the protesters because of my ethnic and background and my age and everything like that. But probably had an easier time being neutral and reporting neutrally because of the experiences I've had and because this is not something that I write about all the time. You know, I'm coming from a sports background. So I was really, honestly, a blank slate coming into Ferguson. So for me, it wasn't as difficult. The nice thing about being Black is that I wasn't attacked out there. I saw Arabic Al Jazeera reporters attacked, had one of their cameras broken. I saw white photographers attacked because people kind of resent the outside influence happening here. But I was able to blend in a little bit and avoid any kind of detection as a media person in some instances.
Robert, I want to ask you a question that is kind of unfair to ask because there's no way you can really know the answer to this. But since you were there on site for a couple of days, Andy and I were not. If nothing else, you'll have a better kind of educated prediction or guess as to what the answer would be. Where do you see this? Where do you see the resolution existing, if there is even indeed a resolution? I think it's unfair for me to sort of compare this to quote-unquote other riots because I'm not an academic and I'm not a historian. But already, if you look at how many days people have been in protesting Ferguson versus Watts and versus other similar situations in this country, it's already lasted a lot longer, which is kind of incredible if you think about it. So you were on the streets during those nights. As we tape this, it doesn't look like things are abating so quickly. Do you have any kind of sense as to what, if any kind of resolution will happen?
You know, I went into it thinking that maybe I'd get a feel for when it would end after a couple days of experiencing it. And then just being out there and seeing how just the smallest thing can set off unrest and violence, I learned to stop predicting the situation. I mean, we're standing out there the other night, and the ministers and pastors and Muslims and organized this giant prayer circle at 12:35 a.m. And I'm thinking, wow, this is the first time I've seen this. Nobody's being violent. I'm not seeing the kids under the influence of pot and alcohol that I was seeing the last few days. The police seem to have a better handle of this situation, a bigger, larger presence. I think there might not be violence tonight. And then somebody throws a single water bottle at a line of police that misses the cop, and everything starts up again. And there's 47 arrests between 12:30 in the morning and 1 in the morning. In that 30 minutes, there were 47 arrests. So it's a completely unpredictable situation. People are incensed, not just because of Michael Brown, not just because of the way the case is being handled, but because of the atmosphere that already existed around Ferguson. So I think that to try to guess at what's going to happen, it would really be kind of silly. But I know that if the man is not prosecuted to the satisfaction of this community, the unrest will continue.
All right, and then finally, Robert, and this is one of the questions that kept coming up on Twitter when we put it out there saying that we were going to tape a podcast with you in different sort of forms. And I thought it was a really smart question by the people who were interested. And that is, you know, how do you go back? I mean, that's not the right way to phrase it. But when you go back to covering the NFL and covering games, how are you going to feel about that? You just sort of were covering something that's so much more important, that has so many more layers. Now you're ultimately just heading back to something that, while it is so important to so many people, it really is just a game. It really doesn't have any larger significance than what we give it as sort of fans and fandom. So is this going to stay with you for the next couple months? Do you think it will impact you when you're in a locker room or a press box? Or you're looking at it another way that, listen, this was an assignment. This was my life for 4 days. And I have to move on because my job ultimately is to be a writer and reporter covering the National Football League.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've thought about this for the last probably 24 hours. You know, how do I go back to covering a football game after seeing all of that and realizing how many eyes are on that situation as opposed to the NFL? You know, when you cover a sport, you think, gosh, this is the most important thing going, because you have to keep going and working hard, but it's not. The cool thing about working for the NMQB, a shameless plug here, but I think that we get to do feature stories that matter to us more than a lot of different outlets. So I'm not going to a game and necessarily writing about the quarterback play or just, you know, why a team won or it lost. I certainly write those articles, but the ones that I really take pride in are, for instance, you know, talking to gay ex-players who are out of the closet and talking to them about their lives and what it was like to be in the NFL and what it must be like for the closeted players now. those issues feel as important or almost as important as what I covered this week. And I think that as long as we still have the freedom and the mandate to tell special stories that, you know, give you a glimpse at humanity through the vehicle of sport, I think that, you know, I'll still be just as committed and hopefully my stuff is just as good.
All right, this has been a special Monday Morning Quarterback podcast with Robert Klemko, who spent 4 days in Ferguson, Missouri. And if you've just listened to the last 25 minutes or so recounting his experiences there and just sort of what he came away from covering that story, which goes on as we are taping this podcast. My thanks to Robert Klemko for calling in. Andy DeGore is the producer of this. We appreciate Peter King suggesting this. This came from him. He wanted to have a podcast with Robert's experience and to let the readers of the Monday Morning Quarterback know what his last week has been when he has sort of stepped away from the drumbeat of training camp to cover something that is just far more momentous and one of the bigger stories that has hit this country certainly this year. All right, I'm Richard Deitch. Not sure when I'll be back hosting another MQB podcast, but we hope you enjoyed and appreciated Robert's experience and honesty in covering this story. We will we'll see him once again down the road on the MQB podcast.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.